So I'm kind of back to this topic again of regularization and renormalization of sigma models. And to be honest, the reason that I keep talking about this is that I want to understand how to do the computations myself, and I still don't quite. But the whole point is to make everybody watch while I teach myself how to do these computations, roughly speaking. So there are two somewhat related issues. One is the issue of how are we going to regularize the path integrals that come up in the theory of sigma models, and the other is how are we going to renormalize the resulting theories. So the kind of standard example that everybody starts with in discussing quantum field theories is so-called phi cube theory. And that's a theory of a scalar field, say, in d dimensions. Which has a very simple Lagrangian. The Lagrangian for the scalar field, it'll have a derivative term, a mass term, and a cubic term. So let me write it out the way I want it. So typically one writes the terms like this, and then there's some coupling constant multiplying the phi cube term. So m is supposed to be the mass of the corresponding particle, corresponding field. G is the strength of this so-called cubic interaction that you get in this Lagrangian. So this is not an interesting physical theory, but it's an interesting example that people tend to use to illustrate the behavior of quantum field theory. So the idea that goes back to Feynman is that the physical quantities that you want to discuss are going to involve, well, the insertion of some operators which take values on the field, and then some integral of the exponentiated Lagrangian, and now we have to integrate over all possible fields. So that's a kind of schematic representation of the kind of integral that we want to do. And the problem is that these path integrals are infinite dimensional. Sorry, a real physicist puts the d phi at the beginning of the path integral. Don't ask me why. Pardon?
We forget what we're integrating over by the time we get.
Yeah, but maybe you should study the German language where the verb comes at the end or something. I don't know.
The verb is in the second position.
Pardon?
The verb is normally in like the second position in German.
See, right after the integral sign, then you've got your verb, and then you've got.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so so the idea is to expand as a function of the coupling G. So you first imagine treating a theory without the cubic interaction, and if you're treating a theory without the cubic interaction, then this is essentially a Gaussian integral. So it's an infinite dimensional Gaussian integral, but there are formulas for finite dimensional Gaussian integrals, and One assumes that those formulas are well-behaved. So I guess the proper way of doing that is to say that one needs to define the function spaces over which one is integrating in such a way that the Gaussian integrals have the right answer. But then with these phi cube terms included, you don't just have Gaussian integrals anymore. And there's a sort of asymptotic expansion of the integral which was worked out by Feynman. So these Feynman expansions have a number of difficulties. One difficulty is that it's only an asymptotic expansion, so the even when the Feynman expansion makes sense, the series that you get doesn't actually converge to the answer that you want. It's only an asymptotic expansion. But the problem, there are additional problems, which are that the terms in the series are themselves infinite. So it's basically ever since the 40s, when this was first written down, there's been this disconnect between the very accurate computations that physicists make using this technology and the disquiet that mathematicians have when they're confronted with an asymptotic expansion, none of whose terms converge individually, much less the whole sum converging. So, but the basic picture is to, so I don't really want to give a short course in the next 10 minutes in Feynman expansions, but the basic idea, well, first of all, you should do a Fourier transform into momentum space to use momentum variables instead of using position variables. And the reason for that has more to do with how we're going to regularize the integral than anything else. And once you've made the Fourier transform to momentum variables, then you write the entire integral as a sum of terms, and these terms are sort of combinatorially labeled by Feynman diagrams. And the typical sort of term involves an integral over momentum space, and you have things like various momenta which may get shifted by various inputs and outputs, things of that sort, integrals of this rough form. So this is a typical type of term in such an expansion. So the problem is that these integrals themselves diverge. They're integrals over a finite dimensional space, so that's okay. But the integrals themselves diverge, and even once we learn how to make them kind of convergent, the series that they define also doesn't converge. But nevertheless, this is actually a good way to get approximations to the physical quantities that are being measured. And the approximations are so accurate that one often hears the claim that the quantum electrodynamics, the first quantum field theory that was done in detail, produces an agreement between theory and experiment of 10 significant figures, which is pretty remarkable. So the task today is going to be to understand what kinds of tricks are used to make sense out of these terms in the Feynman expansions, and the other question of what kind of convergence do we get from this perturbative analysis of a quantum field theory is something we're not really going to discuss today at all. So there are some basic ideas for regularizing these integrals. There are three basic regularization methods that I'm aware of. One is to replace space-time with a lattice. essentially z to the d instead of r to the d. It doesn't really have to be a rectangular lattice. People who do explicit calculations tend to use a rectangular lattice for this purpose. And so what's then required is to have discrete analogs of all the continuous quantities in the theory. And there's going to be a basic distance scale, which is going to be the lattice spacing. And as you let the lattice spacing go to zero, you find certain kinds of divergences, and part of your aim is to construct a lattice theory so that you have the asymptotic behavior of all those divergences under control, and you have some way of regularizing the theory. So the theory at lattice scale A itself somehow makes sense, and then you try to define, you try to understand how the theory behaves as a function of A. So I'm not going to follow that approach here at all. I just mentioned it as one of three possible methods that people have often discussed in terms of quantum field theories. And I think it's pretty common, it's a pretty common philosophical stance if a quantum field theorist gets into an argument with a mathematician about whether the quantum field theories exist or not, to fall back to lattice regularization as the sort of definite proof that something is going on that makes sense in quantum field theories. I should say that the lattice treatment of fermions, for example, is still somewhat unsatisfactory. There are various issues with respect to supersymmetric theories, which are tricky to do in the lattice. So if you're interested in some of those kinds of physical theories, that might not be the best philosophical stance to have adopted. But that's one which often people kind of fall back on. Second regularization method is called momentum cutoff. And in momentum cutoff, what we're going to do is only consider the momentum integrals from some lower momentum to some upper momentum. And we'll still treat this kind of integral with these product of quadratic things in the denominator, typically. So in the momentum cutoff theory, either the entire path integral rewritten in momentum variables or the individual Feynman terms can be thought of as you're only to carry out the integration over a limited range of possible frequencies between mu and lambda. And then you try to study what happens as you vary these frequencies. So typically, the problem of divergence shows up when you let lambda go to infinity. The thing is divergent. And the idea, which really kind of led to what's called Wilsonian renormalization theory, so the renormalization of the divergences in these integrals is older than that. Already, Feynman and Schwinger and people of the earlier generation were subtracting off divergent quantities to extract convergent answers from this basic technique. But in the 1960s, Ken Wilson came up with a systematic description of what was going on, a kind of reformulation of what these renormalization methods meant. And essentially, the idea is to... I was going to do regularization before I did renormalization. So here the regularization is to just cut off the integral at lambda and mu, and so little mu is going to somehow set the scale. And the point is that by letting lambda get larger and varying what you do with the actual coupling constants in the integrand, so in my phi cube theory I will possibly let M and G be mu dependent. By letting M and G be mu dependent, I can reproduce the different possible behaviors depending on what I would have gotten out of my integral. So it's not obvious that you could do that. We'll talk in just a minute in some easy case about the kind of manipulation you have to make in order to do that. But that's the basic idea. And so then you sort of study how these guys depend on the scale mu. And well, that leads to renormalization, which is the other part of the story. So we can get finite answers by discretizing the problem. We can get finite answers by taking momentum cutoff. And the third finite, the third regularization method is called dimensional regularization. And that's what I want to discuss for a while. So dimensional regularization is not something that you can make sense of in even formally for the original path integral. Dimensional regularization applies term by term in the Feynman expansion. And just to kind of give you a typical a picture of what it does, let's say we just had a very simple looking momentum integral like that, dq over q squared plus m squared. That is a typical thing that you have to calculate for, say, calculating two-point functions. And in the two-dimensional sigma model, which is of interest, these integrals are important. So you might have dq over q squared plus m squared. And, of course, it's divergent. So one regularization was to kind of take these cutoffs. But I'm going to use a little trick, which is to write an integral to rewrite this in terms of an integral of another variable sigma from 0 to infinity of e to the minus sigma times q squared plus m squared d sigma. And of course, I've still got a dq here. Oh, sorry, the d sigma I already put there. And I still have a dq in this story. So by the way, this q, I'm being a little sloppy here, quite deliberately. This is, of course, the product of various momentum variables in the different dimensions. There are d dimensions here. And this q squared really means norm q squared. So this is still norm q squared up here. And this is a positive quantity, which is what we needed in order to make sense of an integral like this. So the basic, I'm interchanging limits here, but the basic integration point is that e to the minus a sigma d sigma from 0 to infinity is 1 over a if a is positive. So the sum of squares, I can apply such a thing too. And now I can actually imagine doing this integral completely. So this is just some quadratic expression in d variables. And it's essentially a Gaussian integrand, an integral. I'm not going to do anything to the e to the minus sigma m squared term. But what I'm going to get out what I'm going to end up with from doing the Gaussian integral is just pi to the minus d over 2 to the minus d. Right? That's just the standard root pi over 2 answer that you get from doing those integrals. So now I've sort of removed these momentum cutoffs. So this is the answer. Sorry. At a specific any specific value of sigma, this is the answer. Sigma not equal to 0 or infinity, that's the answer that I get from doing that Gaussian integral. The problem is that this is now a divergent integral of sigma. So I've traded one divergent integral for another, but it's something that one can control very Precisely. It's 1 over 2 pi times 1 over 2 minus d plus things that are regular at d. So it's a divergent integral, and d was the dimension in here. That's sort of how I got this particular factor. But now I treat d as a continuous variable and try to do the integral as a continuous variable, and doing it gives me a result like this. So what does this mean?
You took limits, right?
Well, I'm cheating all sorts of ways, right? So for fixed values of sigma, I could let these limits go to infinity and perform the integral. So for each fixed value of sigma, that makes sense. But now I can't actually do that integral at the value that I care about, d equal 2. I should have said I was doing two variables for this particular integral. At the value I care about, I can't actually do that integral from 0 to infinity because I'll get infinity as an answer. So I get, you know, a divergent quantity. It's still a divergent quantity. But now the point is, if I say consider this expression, this integral, for real d sufficiently small, then it converges. And I can do analytic continuation back to the place where I was interested in doing the integral, back to the positive numbers, and I discover regular at 2. I discover this behavior of the analytically continued function, which is a simple pole at d equal 2, and then something which is regular. So in dimensional regularization, we now want to alter the... So we alter the quantities in the original problem, such as M and G, so that they depend at a given scale on, so maybe mass is mu to the D minus 2, on some mass term plus some quantity that formally diverges. So I'm going to put a d minus 2 there. Maybe there's an h bar that goes in there. And then maybe there's something that I forgot to write down in my notes, which is multiplying it. So that when I use this value, I end up with an extra term in the integrand formally. Again, I'm doing these things term by term and doing the momentum integral first after having introduced this auxiliary sigma, and then treating this as an expression that has a d dependence and that I use analytic continuation to understand, I end up with, from some appropriate substitution like that, I end up with, was it the mass or the coupling that I was supposed to give the pole to? I've forgotten. Anyway, I end up with a cancellation of this quantity. So before I regularized, I didn't really tell you how I was regularizing with momentum cutoff, but I regularized by somehow considering approximate versions of the theory, which would allow me to, so if I make mu, if I define mu in the right way and sort of relate mu and lambda in the right way, then I can actually make sense of the limit in the momentum cutoff regularization. Here, in the dimensional regularization, I'm going to allow some kind of d-dependent pole. I imagine that I'm doing the theory for some value of the dimension that's a little different from 2, and then it makes sense to talk about the theory, and then I take the limit to d equal 2. So it's only because all of the integrals that I wanted to do over my spacetime, my d-dimensional spacetime, maybe I'm in Euclidean signature, all the integrals that I wanted to do, I actually Fourier transformed to momentum space and then used this kind of trick to turn it into a d-dependent quantity rather than actually doing the integral. So the reason you can't do this for the original path integral is that the original path integral involves things other than quadratic functions somehow. So here, any dependence on momentum other than quadratic, I've essentially suppressed by using the Feynman diagram expansion where the momenta only appear quadratically, and then for quadratically appearing momenta, I'm able to use this trick and do the dimensional regularization. That's the basic idea for dimensional regularization, and I'm still kind of struggling personally with how to make it work in the sigma model context. So the quantity that I just wrote down is kind of the crucial one. And to apply this to the sigma model, what we need is some understanding of where the divergences might be coming from in the Feynman expansion. And, well, anyway, it starts to get a little technical, and I got a little lost when I was trying to prepare the talk, so I'll just give you a kind of crude version of the story. So I remind you that for the sigma model, we were interested in a phi, which was not just a scalar field, but the phi was thought of as a map from our spacetime into some manifold. And then the manifold had some geometric data, which was going to help us understand the field theory on phi. So the geometric data consisted of a metric on the spacetime, together with sometimes an extra two-form field, or some extra scalars. There were these terms that might be proportional to certain curvature terms, which get added to these sigma models in general. But the basic geometric data was to have some target manifold with a metric and possibly a two-form on that target manifold. And then the Lagrangian had a term where we pulled back the metric from the target manifold to the spacetime, and then typically also we might have to integrate the d is equal to 2. Well, this is my problem. I don't want to set d equal to 2 because I've got formulas like that, but d is equal to 2. So when I talk about having a two-form field term, I really mean that I pulled back that two-form field, and that gave me an extra term, so-called topological term, integrated over R2. Or this might be a more general d-dimensional space-time in which I'm talking about the quantum field theory. And then there were these other terms, a term proportional to the curvature of the metric, total scalar curvature, so that had to be pulled back, and maybe that had some coefficient, and then maybe that's the only other term that I really need in this theory. So this is the Lagrangian, and what makes it much more complicated than the simple kind of theory that I wrote down before is that the arbitrariness of this metric on the target space means that I'm not just in the realm of some simple function in space-time and polynomial interaction term. I've got complicated interactions which are determined by the metric on the target space. So the way to organize what's going on here is to start with some initial metric on the target space and then take perturbations of that initial metric and regard the entire metric as somehow being a small variation of some initial metric. So we start with some initial metric, which we might need to assume has some nice properties, and we're interested in how things change when we perturb that. And so now there are some lovely formulas, which right. So the the perturbed action, which is going to depend I mean, I can write out things like this, but I'm not sure I've done enough of the background for it to make sense. So this is the kind of local coordinate version of the terms in the Lagrangian. There's some function u there are there's some vector fields, there are I haven't done enough background to explain where this kind of expansion is going to come from, which is why I got stuck when preparing this lecture, because I got stuck at this point. So let me just say what the basic point would be. So instead of kind of carrying out the entire integral, we only want to know the leading order contributions to a variation in that integral from a change in the metric. And sort of assuming that we can make the whole regularization and renormalization business work for Gij0, we then kind of see how it changes when we make changes in the metric. So rather than treating so what I did, the little trick I pulled in the phi cube theory was to essentially treat the Lagrangian as a perturbation of the part which could be evaluated using Gaussian integrals, the quadratic piece, plus a cubic piece, which was thought of as a perturbation of the quadratic piece. Here, the term that I'm trying to perturb is a complicated nonlinear theory all of itself, but we somehow assume that we have it under control and we want to know how it would change if we vary the metric. So the variation of the metric is kind of the only thing that's going to be kept track of in this picture. And the so the part that I'm kind of going to skip is the part where one sort of calculates where the divergent quantities are going to come from, and they're supposed to come from two kinds of terms, this curvature term that I had to put in the Lagrangian, and another term which looks like, so there was another auxiliary function u which got, which came in here as well, another term which involves the gradient of what in the world is gradient? This is the small variation in phi. This is the small variation in u. So I take the gradient of that guy, and I have to take it essentially the difference of the uh, the difference of the gradient of that guy at the value of phi that I'm looking at minus the original difference. So the change in the gradient of this small variation in u. So there are these two quantities, and when you write out what the two quantities do in dimensional regularization, you end up with some expression which looks very much like well, first of all, it's got the 2 minus d part. The 2 minus d part comes from the dimensional regularization maneuver. And what's left over is coming from what was multiplying those simple-looking dq over q squared plus m squared type terms in the integrand. So when you do a Feynman expansion, there is this nice formal way to read off of the properties of the terms in the Lagrangian, how to build these momentum integrals. And so when I speak of insertion of these quantities, these operators at these points, appropriate things will end up getting multiplying terms like the integral over momentum. And those turn out in this specific context to involve very explicit expressions for the fields phi and u together with the curvature, which occurred in the Lagrangian. So this is things, this is the polar part, so it's plus things regular at d equal 2. So the definition that you end up making for the kind of regularized values of the inputs that we're putting in here are a metric which looks like the original metric plus the h bar counts the terms in the Feynman expansion plus some kind of variation that some kind of variation of the metric. This is the sort of general form that you would want for the quantities to get rid of the polar part. And in this particular case, to get the poles exactly in that form to cancel, so this is a tensor, you want that small variation delta G1 to be of the form Rij. Well, you're actually seeing a Ricci tensor there. So that one was a calculation. This is the values of the couplings that you want to use to make those cancel out. And the field U is supposed to be a half of the Laplacian with respect to G of the original guy U. So these two geometric quantities of the function u on the target manifold together with the metric on the target manifold are the things which sort of come out of this computation of what dimensional regularization is supposed to be doing. So again, I apologize that it's not so clear how the computation is made, but the basic strategy again is to write out the Lagrangian in this form, to do a Feynman expansion for the Lagrangian considering the sort of basic part, the Gij0, as something that's given, to work out where the divergent contributions to things like the two-point function, which I'm calculating here, would come in the Feynman story. You then convert any actual momentum integrals occurring in those divergent diagrams into expressions that involve the dimension D in dimensional regularization. So we're going to throw away any regular terms for the purposes of calculating the behavior of the coupling constants in that integral, the g and the u, and then you kind of read off from that calculation how it is you're supposed to vary the coupling constants in order to make sure that those divergences get canceled. So that's the basic regularization scheme. At one loop. So I remind you that another feature of the Feynman expansion is that it's this series expansion in this parameter h bar. The power of h bar counts how many loops there are in the diagrams, and what I wrote for you was all of the one loop diagrams which contributed divergent quantities to these two-point functions that we were just calculating. But you can go further. You can sort of start to write down all of the two-loop diagrams that might compute divergent quantity, contribute divergent quantities, all the three-loop diagrams, and so on. And it gets more and more complicated because it involves higher and higher terms in a series like this, a perturbation of the metric around an original metric, which will translate into other curvature and derivative terms showing up actually in the Feynman expansions, the interaction vertices that are used in the Feynman expansion, and that will cause other terms which involve higher h bar, higher powers of h bar, to show up in these divergent quantities here and need to be canceled, and then they're canceled by including h bar squared terms, which also may have poles and so on, in 2 minus d. So this was an approximation that was good to that first order in the Feynman expansion, and you could imagine making, and people have carried out for at least, you know, at least 4 or 5 loops worth explicitly, you could imagine making similar computations that would show how the thing could be regularized to larger and larger order in the Feynman expansion. So you need more and more control over the behavior of G0 and U0. And again, it's only this kind of asymptotic expansion in H-bar rather than something which is convergent. It's also got these sort of annoying infinities in the denominator in the expansion. But once we've, in the Feynman expansion, sort of converted all of our momentum integrals into quantities that depend on the dimension and are defined by analytic continuation, then that actually makes sense. So there's a scale here which was implicitly inserted. And I can explain the scale better in momentum cutoff regularization in the Wilsonian point of view than I can in this context. But there's an interplay between the size of the h bar that's used in the Feynman expansion and this scale, it seems to me, and the effects of various powers of h-bar will sort of become important at various scales that you might be using. Nevertheless, there's a kind of formal way of extracting the renormalization quantities. Which is to keep the G0 and mu0 fixed, fixed, and calculate the logarithmic derivative with respect to the scale mu of the quantities that are involved. So you end up with so there's some powers of D which I'm getting a little confused, but you end up with some expression which tells you that the D derivative of g up to some constant having to do with the power of the scale that's appearing there looks like the Ricci tensor, and the logarithmic derivative of the function mu is proportional to this Laplacian of mu. And these quantities determine the renormalization flow. In other words, how the quantities are supposed to change when you change distance scale of the effective model in the space of all possible theories. So the space of theories in this case is the space of metrics and these auxiliary functions u, also potentially a multiplier of the curvature and a two-form, which we're not really discussing today. And as I've described before, a key question is what's the behavior of those quantities with respect to this flow? And, well, I didn't get a minus sign, but that's because I haven't actually done the computation correctly. But the basic lesson from this would be that you would expect to see at different distance scales, so t now represents a distance scale, or maybe the exponential of the distance scale, you would expect to see a behavior to one loop like this, which would be corrected if you did the higher loop approximations by other quantities that were involved there. And similarly, this function u, which came along in these sigma models, would transform according to the Laplacian, a differential equation based on the Laplacian. So anyway, my goal for this week, my personal goal for this week, was to try to get so that I could calculate this part for you, and I can't do that quite yet. And I think, as a result, I'm going to finish a little bit early. And whether or not we have the next part of this talk next week depends on whether I know how to do those calculations by next Friday or not. So it's either going to be next Friday or it's going to be sometime in the spring quarter. But I think I'll stop there and ask if there are any questions and apologize for the somewhat disorganized nature of today.
So the references to Friedan's
paper? Friedan's paper, these lecture notes of Govitsky that I mentioned last time, some earlier lecture, so they're in the quantum field theories, Quantum Fields and Strings, A Course for Mathematicians book from the Institute. So I was really more following Govitsky. Friedan has everything in components, and it's kind of hard to see what's going on in his treatment. Govitsky's paper, every time I sit down with it, I think, yes, I understand that, until I start to get sort of between the lines, and then I find I don't understand it quite as well as I thought I did. So.
Details on the reference, I wasn't there for the earlier.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So this is Govitsky. Well, you're supposed to decorate some letter someplace in there. It's in this collection called Quantum Fields and Strings. It's in volume 2 of Quantum Fields and Strings. I think it's called A Course for Mathematicians, which is published by the American Math Society, Mathematicians, AMS, it must be like 98 or 99. And it was the proceedings of the special year at IAS in 96-97, in which a bunch of physicists tried to explain quantum field theory and string theory to a bunch of mathematicians. So chapter 3 of his lectures is about sigma models. And he has 4 chapters. All right, I will quit for today. Yeah.
At least the